I had an opportunity to brag about all of you this afternoon. I had a wonderful blast from the past. At my office door at about 2 o'clock showed up two faces I had not seen for probably 16, 17 years. People way back from my very first church, Steve and Val Zabraski, who happened to find me because his sister and his mother grew up here in West Bend. Does anyone recognize the last name Zabraski? Although, I guess his mother would be a Zabraski. She's in care in one of our senior homes, but it's not Cedar, and his sister lives in the area as well, and hadn't seen them for 15, 16 years. Had a wonderful time talking with them and sharing memories and talking about how I've grown and how things have changed and what life has been like since I moved on from College Park to Connecticut and then to here. And then I showed them the sanctuary, and they loved the sanctuary. And then I said, you know, here's the great thing tonight. I have the creme de la creme. I have the cream of the crop, the people that really, they come on Sundays and they're interested in Sunday and they serve and they're volunteering, but they're the ones that actually have gone through for the last 9 years with me every aspect of the Bible story from Genesis to now Acts, even the boring parts, even the difficult parts, even the challenging parts. And knowing Steve and Val, and it's the environment I came from where I was taught to highly appreciate the whole of the Bible story, they were absolutely pleased that that was going on here. They were excited. So hopefully next time they come up here, we'll get them out here at a time where they can come and join us in service. Just wanted to say I had an opportunity to brag about you because I really do appreciate this group. You guys are going through some very, you know, esoteric in some sense. People don't focus on the passages we're focusing on. They move past them very quickly. And one of those passages is the passage we're on right now, Acts 24. We're going to try to cover the whole chapter as we are still with Paul, who is still in Roman custody. That's where our story begins. It's where it's begun for the last 3 or 4 weeks. He's still in Roman custody, and he's in custody because he was arrested at a riot, which was not of his devising. He didn't create the riot. He was actually the principal player that the rioters were after. They dragged him out of the temple, you might recall. They wanted to kill him. The Romans stepped in and saved Paul's hide so that he wasn't killed by those who were against him. But in the meanwhile, while he was in Roman captivity, there was a plot that you might recall too, weeks back, where a bunch of people got together, 40 men, and decided they're not going to eat until they see Paul dead. And they were going to try to assassinate Paul when the Roman commander would bring him out into the Sanhedrin's presence for the second time. Well, the commander caught hint of that, and so the commander brought Paul all the way from Jerusalem up to Caesarea, where the Roman procurator, or the governor, Pontius Pilate was the previous Roman governor, now it's Felix. He brings him all the way up to Caesarea because his life's in peril in the area of Jerusalem. But still there's this question, what to do with Paul? No one really knows, so he's left in Caesarea until finally there can be a trial. A trial where his accusers from Jerusalem can present their case before Felix, much like in Jesus' time, the Jewish enemies of Christ would present their case to Pontius Pilate and then have Pilate make the decision. That's what's happening here, although they've taken him all the way up to Caesarea, where Pilate would have normally been, and now you find Felix. So we're getting ready to go into a trial. This is full Perry Mason mode. This is a trial where Paul is going to stand in his own defense, but he has some real big shoes to fill in the sense that his opposition has hired the best lawyer they can find. So we're going to look at the three main players in this trial in verse 1. They pop out right away. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea, and really he would have went up, but when you move from Jerusalem, you're always going down because it's on a hill, with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor, whose name is Felix. So here's your three key players. You have Felix, who rules as the Roman governor of Judea from 52 to 59. So at this point, it's AD 57 or so, and he has ruled over Judea for about 5 years. He is the man that makes all the decisions pertaining to life and death and Roman overseeing of Judea. Tertullus is the lawyer that's been hired by Ananias, who we know all the way back to the trial of Jesus. Caiaphas and Ananias, Caiaphas being the father and Ananias being the son. Ananias brings a whole delegation of Jewish elders up to Caesarea But they don't come alone. They come with the accompaniment of this Tertullus guy, who is not a Jew. He's a Gentile, and he appears to be an expert orator. He is the best lawyer they can find to present their case so that they can hopefully be done with Paul once and for all. So we're about ready to hear Golden Tongue Tertullus make his case. They're paying a lot of money for this guy to make his case, and here's the brilliant speech he's about to present in order to finally take care of Paul as the pest he is once for all. So verse 2, when Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. Are you ready? We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. But in order not to worry you further, I know you could listen to us fawn over you all day, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly. So, you know, he's an expert orator, and he knows that all the power is in Felix's hand. And so he's going to butter him up. You flatter him. And he makes sure the flattery comes on thick. He says, Felix, you are a gem. You've brought peace to this area. Everybody knows this everywhere and anywhere. Everywhere you go, it's just, you know, butterflies and rainbows and unicorns. It's just a beautiful place here in Judea, which is interesting because even historians in Felix's time write of how seething discontent was rumbling within Judea that often erupted in riots. Riots like the one we just read about a few weeks ago, where the people riot because they want to kill Paul because they see him as a heretic and undermining the Jewish tradition. So that hardly was it the case that peace was the constant experience of the people of Judea. But Tertullus does this because he wants to pave the way for his accusation that Judea would be full of peace if it weren't for pests like Paul who seek to disrupt the peace. You know, he's the problem. And everything'd be wonderful if it weren't for guys like this. So let me make my charges. Let me tell you what the problem is with this character named Paul. And here come the charges in verse 5 and 6. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him. Now, it's interesting, and you need to pay attention to the charges because they're threefold. He's a troublemaker, he is an agitator of the Jews, stirring up riots, and he's a ringleader of a sect. All of those charges are meant to enforce the fact that he is a person of sedition. He brings nothing but unrest. He disrupts the peace. The Romans, who would be very anxious about anyone disturbing the peace that Rome creates through its own oppression, would hear words like troublemaker, agitator, rioter, ringleader. They'd hear all of those words in a very negative way. They'd hear them in the same way we hear terrorist. They'd hear, this guy is no good in any possible way. All he does is stir up trouble everywhere he goes. And in fact, we saw him, verse 6, desecrate the temple, and so, as a favor to you Romans, we seized him. And at this point, if you know the story, you know that there's only a half-truth there. In fact, there's a bigger bit of a lie there, because there had been a riot in the temple in Jerusalem, but it wasn't because of Paul. It was because of them. They wanted to seize and kill him. And it wasn't the Jews that seized him. Well, you could say they did try to seize him, but they were trying to seize him to kill him. You know, so they wanted to seize him to plunge a knife in and get rid of him once for all. It is the Romans who, after the Jews had seized him, that came in and then took Paul captive to save him from his own people. And so there's a bit of half-truths going on, but you ought to expect that when we're playing the game of the system, when we're trying to finagle the legal system that is, and particularly when we're trying to appeal to the kind of characters like Felix, who are going to be buttered up and be very concerned about even any hint of unrest. And so the charges are made, and with that made, Tertullus now closes his case by saying, verse 8, by examining him yourself, Felix, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. So Tertullus says, you'll see we're right. He's trouble with a capital T. Just examine him. Just talk to this guy. Listen to what he has to say, because you'll know he is trouble, big trouble. And then the henchmen, verse 9, the Jews joined in the accusation asserting that these things were true, which means the delegation that has come with Ananias says, yep, that's the fact. He's trouble, all right. He's trouble. So you got this chorus. He's trouble. He's a ringleader. He's a rioter. He is someone that you clearly need to examine, because you'll find he is nothing but unrest. He's no good for the Jews. He's no good for the Romans. So that's where we begin, with Tertullus making his case. Obviously, this is a summary, but that's the essence of the case that Luke wants to record for us. And now Paul has the opportunity to come to his defense. Paul in chains, and here's his defense. And you notice how it's a lot different from Tertullus's flattery. In fact, I invite you to look for some flattery in verse 10. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, "I know that for a number of years you've been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense." Well, you're telling the truth. You've been a judge for many years. Doesn't give the buttering up of, all the good we have is due to you, Felix. You're this wonderful peacemaker. Instead, he says, you've been judge for many years, and it's true. For 5 years, Felix has been judge. And he says, essentially, since you've been judge for 5 years, you know a little bit about the ways of the people of Jerusalem, and you know a lot about the ways of Rome, so I expect a fair hearing from you. I expect you to understand some of what I'm about to say that has to do with my own Jewish tradition and how it in no way conflicts with Roman power. So he's expecting a fair hearing and expecting to be exonerated if Felix will just listen fairly. So that's his beginning, and now here's his story. And his story is very simple. Verse 11. "You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city." I want to start with that. 12 days. And he's making a big point in just a few words. You can verify that no more than 12 days ago I went to Jerusalem to worship. That's what all, agitators do. They go to worship. And that's what point he's trying to make. I went to worship. I went to Jerusalem not because I dishonor my tradition, not because I'm out to destroy the Jewish heritage. I went there to worship just 12 days ago, and it was only 12 days ago, and since you've had me here for at least 5 to 7 days, and it took about a day for me to get here, that means I was actually a free man before I was taken captive for a handful of days, 2, 3, 4 at most. So he's had 2 to 3, 4 or 4 days as a free man, and Paul is essentially saying, 2 or 3 days is hardly sufficient to organize a rebellion. I mean, if I'm going to amass an army to create unrest and cause all kinds of rioting, I'd need more time than that. I haven't been here that long. I just got here and I was almost immediately taken captive. I have no interest in staging an uprising, and there's no proof to those charges. Verse 12 again, "My accusers didn't find me arguing with anyone at the temple. Nobody saw me stirring up a crowd in the synagogues. There's no proof whatsoever." And so in verse 13 he says, "They cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me." There's not one shred of evidence. It's without dispute. There's no one that can come forward and say, "We saw this, we heard this." And so he makes it clear, I'm innocent of their charges. But here's where the script really shifts. Verse 14, "However, I admit." Now stop right there. "However, I admit," you could also translate that word admit, confess. And if I were making this a movie or episode of Paul's tales in the book of Acts, I would put a commercial break right after that. Because when he says, "However, I admit," you should see his enemies licking their lips saying, "Oh, we got him. He's about to confess. He's going to admit his wrongdoing. Perhaps he's going to admit it just to get out of this trouble, maybe make up something, but he's about to confess this wrongdoing." So we're all just waiting with bated breath. What's he going to say? Because he's about to confess. This is great. We finally got him. So I'd put in the commercial break. You'd see Lipitor. You'd see, what's coming up on the news later that evening. And you have another couple of things. Then you'd come back to the program and we'd be right there. And I'd revisit that, "However, I confess," and I'd throw in some violin. And then you'd have him doing this, "However, I confess," and now everyone is disgusted. "I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect, I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and before man. So if you look from verse 14 on, he makes some strong statements. I worship the God of my ancestors. Now, he doesn't say Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because Felix may not know that, but Felix can respect worshiping your ancestors' God. So he knows that Paul is making this commitment to, I'm not doing anything novel or new. I'm still worshiping the God that my whole people have connected their lives to. And then he says, I have complete loyalty to this God. I believe everything that agrees with the law and with the prophets. I have the same hope. I believe, like these people before you, that there will be a resurrection, that God will vindicate the right and judge the wicked, that there is this hope of God bringing all things to a good appointed end through resurrection. So I am a worshiper of the God of the Jewish people. I just happen to be, verse 14, a follower of the way, which they call a sect. And that way, for Paul, is the way in which God has fulfilled God's law and prophetical promises to the people through Jesus. That he sees Jesus as the one who fulfills the law, who fulfills the prophet's expectations, and that's why the church calls it the way. This is the way of Christ. The way that God has brought out God's redemption and salvation through the person of Jesus Christ, so that instead of confessing any guilt, he says, I believe exactly what Ananias does. Although Ananias, being a Sadducee, doesn't believe in resurrection. But that's another point altogether. Perhaps a few of the elders do. But he says, I have the same hope. I worship the same God. I don't know why I'm up here, because I make the same confession they have. And in fact, let me give you further proof. Verse 17. After an absence of several years, and we know what he's doing for those several years, he's spreading the gospel throughout the Gentile region, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. And again, he's underscoring the fact, I came to Jerusalem to bring gifts to the poor. Is that what terrorists do? To bring gifts for those who are needy within the community of the Jews? Am I that antagonistic if I care for the Jewish impoverished? I'm bringing them a gift. And could I possibly be that opposed to the Jewish tradition if I come to present offerings? Which is a way of saying he brings sacrifice. He's fine with bringing that in as being part of his Jewish tradition. And then he says, I was ceremonially clean. I went through the rituals that the Jews have to prepare themselves to worship rightly. And so he's done all these things in accord with the Jewish tradition. Then he underscores it with saying, there's no crowd with me, which means there's no rioters, nor was I involved in any disturbance. So now he comes to his real problem. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Now, you really got to think back to about 3 weeks ago. The rioters that began the riot against Paul and dragged him out of the temple in Jerusalem were not the people located in Jerusalem first and foremost. They got into the act later. It was the Jews from Asia where Paul had been preaching the gospel, the ones that had been disrupted by his preaching in Corinth and other areas, that had come to the ritual, come to the festival, seen Paul, and sought to kill him. So he says, you know, the real people that are against me aren't even here. The real accusers that started this all in the first place, that were the ones that dragged me out, that really want me dead, aren't even here. And so if my accusers aren't here, everything that Tertullus says and Ananias says is hearsay. They can't give you any evidence or direct proof from their own experience or their experience. Instead, my real accusers are a no-show. And since they're a no-show, you should let me go. So verse 20, he concludes by saying, Or these who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. So now he moves, says, my real accusers aren't here. So if you want to talk about accusers that are here, well, here's Ananias and here's a few of the elders. They can accuse me, verse 21, unless it was the one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence. It is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you today. So he says, my real accusers aren't here. And if they're not going to be here, you can't accuse me. And if these guys who saw me in the Sanhedrin have an accusation to make, I'd welcome their accusations. But all they heard me say is, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. And this is his way of simply saying, there's no crime unless believing in resurrection is a crime. And if that's a crime, Ananias and the elders are also guilty. So, he hasn't violated Jewish law. He hasn't violated Roman law, and he wants Felix to understand he's not a threat, he's not a rioter, he's not a troublemaker, he's not a ringleader. He loves his tradition. He hasn't said anything that's different from what the faithful in the Jewish tradition would say about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the love of the law, and the love of the prophets, and the cherishing of Jewish worship. He simply says, there's nothing here. There's absolutely nothing here. And since there's nothing here, then you should let me go. I'm innocent. There are no accusers, and there's no proof. Well, he seems to make a pretty good argument, but I guess I'm biased toward Paul in this whole thing, but I think that's a pretty good argument. It seems to be cohesive and coherent. But Felix isn't nearly as impressed as I am. Verse 22. Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, which is interesting. That's an interesting phrase. He knew a bit about this sect of the Christians. He was well acquainted. He adjourned the proceedings. And then he says, when Lysias the commander comes, he said, I will decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. So he delays the decision. Lysias is the one that first brought him up. And you might recall from last week, Lysias is the one that said, he's innocent. I see no wrong in this guy. So he says, when Lysias comes up, and the understanding is Lysias will bring the Jews from Asia that make the accusation so that they can make the proper accusation, as at least we'll have some real charges from real people who were really there who can actually speak from experience. So he delays the decision until he can hear from the accusers, which seems a little bit unjust on the surface, simply because why aren't the accusers here? This is the trial. They should be at this trial. Why didn't they show for this? Why was it Ananias and the elders and Tertullus? The accuser should have been there, and that's Ananias' fault. So I find a bit of injustice right here, but Felix decides to delay it. But it's interesting because he's acquainted with the way, and that leads to the closing of our chapter, because something very unusual and interesting happens between Felix, Paul, and Drusilla. Felix has put Paul under imprisonment. Now, people can have access to him. They need to provide his food and water. He's under captivity, but he's only under captivity until the accusers come. But Felix wants to have a word privately with Paul, along with his wife. So verse 24, several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. So not only does Felix, as a Roman, have an acquaintance with the way, Drusilla understands the Jewish tradition. So they're very interested in this way. They want to understand it more. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. Now, I love that phrase because that's what Paul's doing. He says, I want to hear about this, and here's what Paul says. I want to talk about faith in Christ Jesus. That's the real topic of discussion. I guess we could talk about injustice, we could talk about a bogus trial, we could talk about no-show witnesses, but I got your ear. Let's talk about faith in Christ Jesus. But what's interesting is many of us would kind of make that faith in Christ Jesus a very simple message. But Paul wants to say faith in Christ Jesus includes things, Felix, that may upset you. They might go against the grain of your lifestyle. And he does this knowing that he's a captive man. He has nothing to gain by making the message harder than it need be. But notice what Paul does in verse 25. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and on the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. So something causes Felix to be afraid. He hears about righteousness or justice. He hears about self-control. And there's a whole story about how Felix got his wife that's dirty and nasty, and I won't tell you it. But that's part of the reason that self-control is not a big topic of his interest. And then the judgment to come, which is to suggest in the end, God's will be accomplished. All will be held accountable to how they lived out God's will or opposed God's will. So he talks about those three things, and I find it interesting, dear friends, that he includes that under the rubric faith in Christ Jesus. That faith in Christ Jesus includes these elements. Now, we could simplify it by saying faith in Christ Jesus here, as Paul is declaring it to Felix, means that Felix will probably have to change his lifestyle. If he's going to believe, he's going to have to be a little bit more self-controlled than he is notoriously known for not being. He's going to have to be a little bit more concerned for justice than he's notoriously known for not being. And he's going to have to remind himself that Rome and Rome's law and Caesar are not the final say in reality. That God has the final word. So he's challenged, and I appreciate that Felix is afraid. At least he's taking it seriously. I think some people hear those things and just, oh, no, God forgives, everything's cool. Felix hears it and he goes, oh, yeah, whoa, hold on, that's enough. I heard all I want to hear. Go back. I understand this far too well. And the reason he does this is very simple, and Luke wants us to know why he's so afraid, and that's why that verse 26 is there. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe. So he sent for him frequently and talked with him. Now all this comes from us understanding the story. If you look at verse 17, after an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. Add to that, Felix knows that Paul has been traveling the world amassing an offering. So that Felix, at least in his mind, understands that Paul has been traveling the world, collecting an offering. He has enough to give very generously to the poor. He has enough to pay for the sacrifices. He has some pretty influential and wealthy friends. So there's some money in this guy. And if I talk to him long enough, I might find that he, like just about any other prisoner, in desperation to get out, will offer a bribe. And Felix is more than ready to take that bribe. I mean, that's why he's listening. He's not just listening because he wants to learn more about the way. He's listening because he'd like to line his pocket. And he thinks Paul might be a wonderful opportunity to line his pocket. I think it's very likely Paul could have had the funds to bribe him. And to bribe him quite generously. But that's not the way of justice. Paul refuses to do what's wrong to get out. He's going to stay imprisoned if necessary rather than offer Felix any kind of bribe. That's simply just not the just way. So Felix seems to want to profit, and at that point you realize this isn't a true unjust judge. He is a judge who is swayed by wealth. He's swayed by money. He's swayed by influence. He really doesn't care what the truth is. He doesn't care what's right or just. He cares what he gets out of it. And all of a sudden you realize we have the true unjust judge of Jesus' parable of the unjust judge. This is an unjust judge indeed, and that's why he starts shivering in his boots when he hears Paul say, righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come. Because he realizes, at least honestly, that that is not the stance that he's taken toward Paul. Well, that leads to the ultimate injustice as our chapter closes. When 2 years had passed, which is a brief way of saying Felix keeps Paul in captivity for 2 whole years. He just does nothing with Paul. Obviously, the accusers do not come. They don't make a case. They're just going to leave Paul to rot and die. And in appeasing Paul's enemies, Felix is just happy to do the unjust thing of keep him in prison. Just keep him in prison. That way I keep them happy. I don't have to deal with the problem. Paul's not going to bribe me anyway. So, there. No justice. Sit in this prison and rot. So when 2 years had passed, thankfully, authorities change. Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and we'll see his story next week. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. Now we'll look at Festus next week. Festus is known to be a very fair and just ruler, much different than many of his predecessors. And so we're kind of hoping for justice at this point as we're reading the story. But the thing you need to note at the very end of the passage is the complete injustice that Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, and he left Paul in prison. So, not only is he unjust, not only is he looking for a bribe from Paul, but he's willing to be unjust and unrighteous as a favor. That's not justice, friends. That's not justice at all. That is inequity and injustice on the highest scale, especially when your job is to do what's right and just, regardless of who it is in your custody. So we see how completely unjust this man, and we're left realizing Paul had to. Paul, who's active, Paul, who wanted to preach the gospel, Paul, who was sitting in this Roman prison, looking out in Caesarea over the harbor, over the beach, realizing that he could see from his prison cell the port from which a ship could take off and he could go preach the gospel to the Gentiles more, which is what his heart's desire was, or even make it to Rome, which was ultimately his heart's desire and what had been promised him by Jesus. But he looks out over this landscape for 2 years without any hope for release, and all of a sudden you realize how devastating this whole situation is for Paul. How difficult it must have been, and how he must have questioned the promise that he had been granted from the risen Jesus, "Paul, you will witness for me in Rome." I think 2 years in prison, you'd be thinking, "I'm not sure that's going to happen. I'm not sure that's ever going to happen. I'm stuck here, and it looks like I'm going to die here, because I've been forgotten by a system that cares less about justice and is more than willing to let me rot rather than to do the right thing." So that's our story. Leads to three reflections, and these are somewhat short reflections because we've covered most of this as we've gone through this. But one of the things that you've noticed me harp on as we go through this again and again, that injustice is at large here. Why this is interesting to bring up now, up to this point, Rome has been a pretty integral and honorable player in our story with Paul. Rome has kept Paul alive. The military commander, Lysias, who brought Paul up to Caesarea, you can't say a bad thing about him. He even says at the end, "I think Paul's innocent." He protects Paul. He keeps him from being assassinated. So that in the lowers of the Roman system, we've seen a sense of nobility and of justice. But when we get to the higher ups in the Roman justice system, we realize that Luke might want to tell us when Rome does well, but Luke's also more than ready to tell us when Rome is unjust and needs to get its act together. He has no problem saying, "This is wrong to its core, and look what it's doing to Paul, and it's all happening because Felix, who knows the truth, refuses to act justly." Instead, he acts as a favor to people he knows have no proof of their charges. And so it's interesting to me that Luke is able to do what I think we all should be able to do, that in our system there are people of great honor and of great capacity for justice and equity that are striving to do their best, and in that same system are those who simply are in it for themselves and greedy gain and would do whatever it takes to line their pockets and bring their reputation up. That's just how systems work. It's naive to say anything different. It's naive to say it's all bad or it's all good. It's always a combination of both. And many times it depends on the person wielding the justice. With Lysias, we saw someone of integrity. With Felix, we see someone of complete and utter injustice. So unjust that there's a certain tragedy to Felix. He has heard the gospel from Paul. If I had one wish in life other than seeing, Jesus in action in some way, shape, or form, and maybe touring with Dream Theater for a year, if I had one wish other than those things, I would wish to be able to hear Paul just talk about faith in Christ Jesus. Sit down here, "Paul, if I can understand you, put it so I can understand Greek that you're going to speak, and I just want to hear you talk about faith in Jesus." What a wonderful opportunity. And Felix had it. He had a one-on-one, personal, clear hearing. So the last thing he can claim is ignorance. He can't say, you know, I didn't know. I didn't know the gospel. I've never heard this before. He's heard it. In fact, he's heard it so clearly, he kind of wishes he hadn't. Enough of that. That's enough. I don't need to hear any more. I don't want to be accountable for any more than what I need to hear. And the reason he won't listen, dear friends, is the reason why some, and perhaps we've been there at times, won't listen. And that is, they know to believe the gospel will demand that they change their lifestyle. It would demand that they change what they value, what they cherish, what they pursue, what they who they are. It would demand a change. And for Felix, he gets it. This wonderful quote by Robert Wall, he says, "How frequently people make decisions against God out of greater concern for their financial situation, political status, or some other reason." Felix is a case in point. Even though Paul's message alarms him, and he realizes the charges against Paul are false, Felix postpones the not guilty verdict to retain custody of Paul in order to extort money from his Jewish enemies. It is his greed and not his ignorance that keeps Felix from faith. That's a long-winded way of saying Felix is subject to that warning that Jesus gives. Better to, why will you gain the whole world and lose your soul? I mean, there's an advantage to not believing. The advantage, you can do what you want. You might even prosper. You know, injustice pays well. It's not like injustice is the poor man's way. You can get far living like a rapscallion. And yet, Felix hears and he knows what's true, but he doesn't want to change. And in not wanting to change, he'll never be able to claim ignorance. We can only pray that Felix rethinks this later in his life. But I think the challenge for us is, how many do we know who react to faith's summons in the same way? I used to act a little like that early on in my ministry, in the sense that, man, if I believe in God, what if I get sent to Zimbabwe? And then I became a believer and worked in a church where they sent me to Zambia, which is just as bad. And I found out it's okay. They didn't keep me there. I got to come home. And actually, I felt God working greatly there, so that I can trust God in whatever God brings my way. Because part of this whole faith thing is trusting God with our future, our life, trusting God that the decisions that may be hard, the disciplines that might be challenging, the justice that might be difficult to oftentimes maintain, is worth it in the end. That it's worth it to live wisely, righteously, justly, with self-control. So that's Felix's tragedy, and of course his tragedy is held in juxtaposition to Paul's faithful witness. And if there's anything you can say that's totally joyful good news in this passage, is Paul keeps his faith in a place where I think many of us, including myself, would start doubting so much. 2 years. Not only that, no one will listen to me. Not only that, I haven't done anything wrong. I don't deserve this. Why am I here? I was just, you know, I'm honoring God, serving God as faithfully as I can, trying to preach the gospel. People want to kill me. People want to lie about me. The government wants to treat me unjustly. They've trapped me here with no hope for release. What's going on? Why, God? Why me? Why this? And I think that you might think, boy, Paul has every opportunity to say, you know, maybe there's a way around this. And you know what his opportunity is? The bribe. He has every opportunity to say, you know, I know he's looking for money, and I know I have money. There's this offering that I brought, and I have friends that I could call on. It's not like I'm without friends of influence, and if I could amass a certain amount of money, I'm sure I could bribe my way out of this. So you imagine Paul had every opportunity to think there was a way out of this, but instead Paul chooses to do the right thing, even though it's the hard thing. Last quote, David Garland says, "Paul's in a sticky situation since Felix holds his fate in his hands. He does not use his time to cajole or smooth talk Felix to win his favor or to try to negotiate with him in hopes of getting his release. Instead, he morally challenges him with God's requirements of righteousness, self-control, and the judgment that will overtake those who've rebelled against God." Which, that makes that even more amazing. That knowing that if he just tells the gospel in a way that's not offensive, that's not demanding, he might get out of there. But he can't but help but give the whole gospel. which is if you're going to follow Jesus, you're going to have to rethink justice, Felix. You're going to have to control yourself. And you're going to have to realize that there's a higher law than Rome's law. There's a higher law than your own law. And so instead of backing down, Paul stands up and he doesn't offer the quick solution of bribery because it's not the Christian way. Instead, he remains true to the gospel, even if it brings suffering. And at that point, you realize how much like Jesus Paul's witness is. That Jesus will refuse to do wrong to get out of trouble. Instead, he'll stay true to what's right, even if it brings him to the cross. And Paul is carrying his cross here and choosing to do what's right and to remain true, even if it brings more suffering. And for maybe one of the last times, I'll say what I've said again and again. You can't but just stand in awe of such incredible faithfulness and say that is a model for us. To look at Paul and say, that's the kind of faith I want to have. That's the kind of commitment that I want to have to the gospel. I don't want to necessarily be in prison, but if it's a choice between doing right and doing wrong and maybe not suffering, I'd rather do right and suffer than do wrong and get off. Would you pray with me?